I first met Michael Malice a year ago today on the set of an ill-fated VH1 talk show entitled Hush Hush, and while I knew that at some point our paths would probably cross, I never thought it would be in this light. He is now the author of Matt Hughes' new book that just came out called Made in America. Some might also know him as the founding editor of Overheard in New York and Overheard in the Office, two very popular blogs. And also where he first came to light on a mainstream level, he's the subject of Ego and Hubris, the Michael Malice story. First off, want to thank Michael for taking the time. I know he's been traveling all over the country promoting his book. And Michael, appreciate you coming out here to talk to us on the park. Matt Hughes, definitely a much maligned character in the world of mixed martial arts, so we're looking to get some answers out of you.
Well, maybe that's why me and him get along. I mean, I've always liked being a villain. I don't think Matt likes being a villain, but I don't think he is a villain. But I just got to correct you quick. I'm the co-author, not the author, so this is very much a team effort.
Right, exactly. My apologies. It's definitely not one of those books where someone says they wrote it and it was really someone else. It definitely a team effort between you and Matt. So thank you for correcting me on that. Let's start at the beginning, because like I said, when I met you, I wouldn't have thought you'd be someone who would pen a mixed martial arts book or any type of combat sports book. How did the relationship between you and Matt first come about?
Well, I you would have guessed correctly. I would have never in a million years have suspected I'd be working on a book like this. Jeremy Ruby Strauss, who's the brainchild behind all the WWE books back in the day, decided to sign a bunch of Ultimate Fighters for biographies to kind of replicate his earlier success. He had a book proposal of mine, which he liked. He liked my style as a writer. So he called me up and he said, "Would you be interested in doing a memoir?" And I said, "Of course." And he goes, "Here's the thing. The guy's a Christian, not ironically." And I said, "That's fine. I have absolutely no problem with that. When I was in college, I was friends with a lot of Christians. I'm not Christian myself, but if anything, it just means he's going to be nice and friendly. So how can you really complain about that?" So I talked to his management. They liked me. I got on the phone with the man himself. We got on great. And then a couple of weeks later, I'm on the plane to Bettendorf, and the rest is history.
Prior to that that meeting, with Matt and his people, and being kind of pitched the idea of writing his memoirs, did you have any idea as to who Matt Hughes was?
Yes, because a friend of a friend is the 60 Minutes producer, Solly, who did that piece, and I knew Jeremy, the editor, who has been talking it up for a while. So I was aware of it. I was certainly not a fan. I didn't really know who Matt Hughes was, but rest assured, when this got, and this is my advice to anyone who wants to be a writer, as soon as this got thrown in my direction, I was on that internet real fast doing the research to find out what the man's all about.
When you're doing this research and learning about Matt Hughes and his history as one of the, probably one of the greatest mixed martial artists of all time, is there a point where you're thinking, well, I don't really know much about this sport. I don't know much about this guy. Maybe I'm not the right guy for the job.
No, that would make me the right guy for the job, because as a writer, I'm just a technician. My job is to make him, help him tell his story as best as possible, and to put as little of my input into this book as I can. So, if anything, someone who is a big fan would probably take too much for granted and assume that things don't need to be explained to the casual reader. Not only that, this book, although it's the first book by a UFC superstar, it gives a lot of behind the scenes, it's also very much a biography and a life story. People think they know Matt Hughes, but from edited little snippets on Tough, you're not going to get a good impression of what he's like as a person.
All right, so talk to us about that first meeting with him. You're face-to-face with Matt Hughes, multiple-time UFC champion, and this guy who, for people who follow his career and people who follow the sport, not known as, one of the most friendly fellows out there. Whether or not that's true or not, we'll get to in a second. But what was that first meeting like? I mean, was he kind of prickly towards you, trying to feel you out? Were you surprised by his behavior? Talk to us a bit about that.
That's a very interesting question, because when we talked on the phone, it's like we're friends for a long, long time. But when I flew into Bettendorf, he was a very different person. Matt is, when he talks about being a family man and all this and that over and over, he really means it. He's someone who does not have much use of being on a pedestal. He wants to be treated like one of the guys. He'd much rather be at home with his wife and his two kids hanging out or working on the farm than training somewhere else. And I think that was part of one of the big reasons why he just opened up his own gym. So when he was in Bettendorf, he wasn't a particularly friendly guy, and it was weird for me because on the phone he was so different. I guess he called me from Hillsborough. But as we drove back to Hillsborough from Bettendorf, the smile started creeping on his face. It was almost like some kind of meter was changing. And once we got there, it was like we're friends for life. What was really funny is I didn't have my contract signed when I was there. So him and his brother liked to tease. I'm from Brooklyn, you know, so if you want to throw, I'll throw down with you. But I had to bite my tongue until that got signed. And once that got signed, let me tell you, I was given as good as I got.
Okay, so the book comes out now in a point where Matt Hughes' career isn't over, actually. This was the case with a lot of wrestling books that some fans out there were kind of disappointed in. When guys come out with books, when the career isn't over, there's still a lot more to be written about, in the next few years of his career, and especially for Matt. Did that ever cross your mind as this might not be the right time for a book? Or if you didn't have that thought, did they ever talk to you about how to deal with that? The fact that his career isn't over, yet you're writing a memoir.
Well, that's a very good question. We had no guidelines from the editors except for make it excellent. And I think, yes, there's a lot of Matt Hughes to come, but on the other hand, he's clearly in a transitional phase, just opening up his own gym and stuff like that. So the book has a very organic ending. I think there's always material for a second book then, you know what I mean? Like he hinted at the end of UFC 79.
Right, exactly. He mentioned that a lot of fans are loving the book, and that he's already getting some feedback as to people wanting to have a sequel, if you will. So when you met, if my timeline is correct, you met Matt Hughes following just a couple months following the loss to George St. Pierre, where he lost his belt, and then he's kind of making this comeback trail leading up to the Chris Lytle bout in March in Columbus, Ohio. What state of mind was Matt in at the time that you met him? Obviously, if you would have met him a year ago or just several months ago after the Hoist Gracie win, it's a guy who's on top of the MMA world. Now he's kind of having to prove himself all over again. How did you view him in terms of his thought process on his career at the moment?
It's going to be hard for you to believe. We never talk shop. We're sitting making fun of me. I'm from New York. He's a farm boy. You can imagine how, we tease each other. But talking about UFC almost never happens. That's his job. He's good at it. He's great at it. And I think a lot of fans think that just because he does it better than anyone else, it should be on his mind and he should be talking about it a lot. But Matt always likes to say, you should be a talker and not a doer, a slogan which Hillary Clinton has recently picked up for her campaign. Yes, well, a doer, not a talker. Excuse me, I got that backwards. That's why I'm the writer, not the fighter. So we didn't really talk about UFC or the Lytle fight or anything like that. All I have to do is to quote Joe Rogan in the road, what was that, 75 or 72, he said, the only person who thinks Chris Lytle is going to win this fight is Chris Lytle and maybe his wife. So I don't think Lytle, though, he's a great athlete, all that, I don't think it was really much of a concern for Matt.
So I'm assuming that you were at the Chris Lytle fight, correct? You were there in person since your relationship was budding at the time?
You can see me on the DVD. I was in the locker room sitting next to Tim Sylvia the entire time, just a fly on the wall watching it, which I suppose is every UFC fan's dream. It was quite an interesting experience.
Now, what does a kid from Brooklyn think? I mean, like you said, just a few months prior, the world of mixed martial arts was the furthest thing from your mind. Now you're sitting in the locker room against UFC heavyweight champ, Matt Hughes, former welterweight champ, while he's getting ready to go into this octagon to beat up another guy. What's going through your mind at that time? It must be insane.
No, because let me give you an example. Tim Sylvia, how he talks. He's got that thick Maine Boston area accent.
Right.
And I'm at his house, and Matt was roommates with Tim. And Tim, finally notices me, and he's like, "Hey, you're from New York. What team do you like, the Yankees or the Mets?" Then I'm like, "The Mets. I could care less." And he goes, "Well, they should like the Red Sox." And I go, "Yeah, well, those people don't know how to talk." And he's like, "What? I'm from there." So, I never had these people on a pedestal. They definitely don't carry themselves in a very kind of look at me, I'm amazing kind of way, especially in the locker room. They're very relaxed. That's their time to get their heads in order. And you'd never know. The background environment at a UFC, at least in this room, it would probably be the same as a background at a high school football game. Guys are, yes, they're getting pumped up, but no one is really acting like, you know, millions or hundreds of thousands of people are going to be seeing me in a few minutes, and, you know, so much money's on the line.
Did you ever get the sense when you're hanging out with Matt Hughes and Tim Sylvia, because of the way that a lot of MMA enthusiasts view those guys, they're viewed as, for the most part, and correct me, you know, if you think I'm wrong, sort of like heels, bad guys. I mean, Matt Hughes isn't exactly a crowd favorite in terms of, like, the, you know, the Chuck Liddell. Tim Sylvia has a lot of detractors. Did you ever get the sense that that bothered them, that they weren't generally loved by the masses in terms of the UFC fans?
Well, that's a great question, and I can answer it with a good answer. When I was a kid, my idol growing up was Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Nice.
So, I mean, I guess a heel is something that I'd be gravitating towards. It's interesting because I think there's a very big, let me talk about Matt first, I guess, in a second. There's a very big disparity, I think, between how Matt is viewed on the internet and how Matt's viewed in the crowds. When we went to Columbus, he had the biggest cheers over even Rich Franklin, which I was amazed because I'm hanging out with the guy, I had no idea how popular he was. And in fact, I interviewed Tim for the book. You may have seen the excerpt where Matt and Tim kind of go at it when Tim first joins the gym, and later, you know, they make amends, and it's very touching and sweet and nice and all that. And I asked him, I'm like, Tim, you know, you kind of sometimes put your foot in the mouth and rub people the wrong way. Like after the Randy Couture fight, you know, Joe Rogan's like, what would you have done differently? And he just says, well, my back was hurting a bit. It sounded like he was making excuses, but she wasn't. He was just, you know, answering the question honestly, but maybe not so tactfully, and it comes off terribly. And Tim just said, put whatever you want. If the fans want to hate me, there's nothing I could do about that. So, and that's what happened.
Interesting. Okay, so talk to us about the actual writing of the book. I think this is something that a lot of people would be interested. How does the whole dynamic work? I mean, are you sitting at a table next to Matt, and he's telling you stories, and you're kind of putting them together in this, you know, nice story? How does the whole thing happen? Because a lot of fans, you know, really have no idea how the whole thing comes about.
I went to live in Hillsboro for a week, I think, like over a period of four different periods. And while we're there, we're hanging out, and we're also spending time working. And I think that's really very important for anyone who's going to co-author a book like this, is to hang out with the person and see them when their guard's down. Because when we first started talking about the book, I was getting kind of these press release answers, and I was really worried. But after you hang out with a guy, you know, stay in his house and play with his kids and talk to his brother and his dad, the real person comes out. Not that there's much difference with Matt, to be honest. The other good thing is being in Hillsboro, a lot of the family's there. So talking to all of them, then I went back to talk to him, and I said, hey, can you tell me about this story and things like that? So after, you know, I kind of gave it a rough draft, we sat down, we went over it together in shifts of a third of the book, and the rest is UFC history.
So you're kind of a investigative reporter. You're trying to dig up some dirt from not just Matt, but from, you know, the locals around Hillsboro, and then you try to bring it back to Matt and get his comments on it?
Right, but I wouldn't call it dirt. He as a Christian, Matt does not think he's a perfect person. If he was a perfect person, he wouldn't need Christ in his life. So a lot of these stories, yeah, he's not particularly maybe proud about it. I put words in his mouth. But at the same time, you know, this is what happened. This is who I am. And I think if you're going to be a good, positive role model, which maybe you disagree about that, but I think a good, positive role model, if it doesn't come from honesty, it's going to fall flat and it's going to be ridiculous. So, my friend, who's a huge, huge MMA fan, he read the manuscript, and he's like, well, I wonder what Matt's going to make you take out of this book. And I said, well, nothing. I mean, this is all clear with him. And he was just shocked because of all the stuff in there and how honest he was. And I'm like, well, that's what Philly's like as a person. He's a totally honest person with no pretensions whatsoever.
So you obviously spent a lot of time with Matt, and obviously when you spend a lot of time with anyone, you might have some ups and downs in your relationships. Was there ever a time when either you or he got annoyed of each other, and you know, maybe the book seemed like it was an endangered species, or was everything all nice and rosy between you two guys?
Well, that's another good question. I'm enough of a sociopath, and when I know things are going in a bad direction, I can swing them in the right direction. But there's actually a very funny story about that, which is he got delayed a day extra in Canada. So instead of us having 3 days or 4 days to work on the book, we had one day left. And as soon as he gets into the house, he announces he's going to spend the next day working on the farm all day. Or he said, work in the farm. Now, in my mind, you know, when I hear work in the farm, I always think sunrise till sunset. And I'm like, we're going to have one day to work on this book. You know, I'm in big trouble. So I'm like, Matt, we got to work tomorrow. And he just starts wagging his finger in my face, and he goes, hey, let me tell you something. I do what I want. And he told me the next day he was going to say, Michael, I'm about to start treating you like family. Well, now, 2 months later, every 5 minutes, you know, whenever one of us does something, whatever, kind of funny, it's, I'm about to start treating you like family. So he's got a very good sense of humor. You can't, the thing that people don't realize about him is that he can give as good as he gets. So I think a lot of these fighters, they see him teasing other people. They would never think to tease back because they have him on this pedestal. So he comes off as aggressive, whereas he can take it just as much as give it out. So that's, I think, where he gets a bit of a bad rap.
So you actually lived in his house, right?
Correct.
And, you know, when the tough, I guess it was tough six, when Dana White, you know, he tells the story of Dana White trying to convince him of being a coach, and he was kind of past the whole Ultimate Fighter experience. He'd done it once, and you know, he was a guest on another season of it, and it seemed as though he wasn't in the right mindset for that. Were you there when he was mulling this over with his wife, with his family, about whether or not to accept, you know, whether or not to accept the invitation to be a coach on Tough Six?
I wasn't there, although I know we talk about it in the book, and I know the thought process. But I mean, just look at it this way. His daughter was taking her first steps with the aid of a chair on a Sunday, and Wednesday he's got to fly to Las Vegas to hang out for 6 weeks with Matt Serra. I mean, what would you expect him to choose?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty easy answer. So, what about that decision? I mean, what made him ultimately choose? Because he talks that he wants to be with his family so much, but then, you know, when push comes to shove, he went and did the show. So what was the deciding factor in making him choose to go on it?
Well, I think Matt is a very, very loyal person, and if the UFC needs something from him, he will absolutely do it. If he needs something from them, they'll probably do it for him. I don't know if you saw that recent interview where he just made it a fact that he will never fight for another organization, so no bother asking. And he sat down with his wife, and they just made a family decision. And she flew out, I think, halfway through the run, so it wasn't too bad for him.
All right, so you mentioned The Ultimate Fighter, and he was, you know, obviously one of the coaches on it, and this particular season was, you know, his big rival, Matt Serra, the guy who hates him so much, going up against Matt Hughes. And if you ask me, going into the show, we talk about heels and baby faces. It was clear that Hughes was the heel, Serra was the baby face, but when the show was over, as much as, you know, I might have some problems with Matt Hughes and, you know, his character outside the octagon, I thought that he came off looking a lot better than Matt Serra. I mean, Serra looked as this guy who might have had this Napoleon complex and thinking that he wasn't as good as Hughes and had to keep trying to put him down. What did you make of the way that Hughes and Serra were portrayed on the show, and did it reflect the way that, you know, Hughes would talk to you? I'm sure he spoke to you about the whole situation with Serra, whether or not you guys wrote about it or not, but off the record, what were your thoughts on watching that show?
Actually, we didn't talk that much about Matt Serra. I can't say I think that much of Matt Serra. I'm from New York City. He's from Long Island, so right away that's 3 or 4 strikes against him. And the thing is, you know, objectively speaking, if Matt Serra was really, his career was doing so well, why would he be asked to be on a show called The Comeback, and why would he accept? Vanderlei Silva just had 3 losses in a row. Can you honestly imagine Vanderlei being asked to be on a show called The Comeback? I mean, it's just absurd. Matt Serra hasn't fought anyone good besides GSP. He hasn't submitted someone in 4 years. I mean, so you can say what you want about Matt Hughes, but there's all these guys who are undefeated till he met them. Sarah's never, you know, taken anyone of note down. I mean, Hoist Gracie, Sean Sherk, Frank Trigg, GSP, they're all undefeated until he met him. He's got more belts than anyone else. So I think Sarah's agenda, although I think that's kind of flattering him because I don't think he's very strategic or thinks things through, maybe otherwise Joey wouldn't be on the show, was to try to hype up the fight and put them on the same plane and make it like kind of this feud, which would make him up on Matt's level because obviously the fighting credentials aren't there.
So that said, and you'd probably be the best person to ask this question, why does a guy like Matt Serra, and for that matter, any of the general internet fans that we spoke about, why do they seem to have this grudge against Hughes? Why do they portray him, not in the same light as a Chuck Liddell, this endearing character that can almost do no wrong, always seems to kind of rub people the wrong way? Why is that in your mind?
Because I think he really has no interest in fame whatsoever or playing the same game. I was actually talking about this with one of the fans on his forum, and it's an interesting question because when I'm hanging out with him, he's always, we're always laughing, he's always smiling. In fact, there's a photo in the book where he's at the typewriter working on the book, and I'm like, you know, make that scowling face at the typewriter like you do at the, in the promos, and he couldn't do it because, you know, he's always having a good time when, you know, he's at home. So I think that kind of rubs people the wrong way. I think people who wear their religion on their sleeve, it makes people feel uncomfortable. I think that's another reason. If I were a fan, I would like someone who has results in the cage. That's the bottom line for me. He finishes fights, and, you know, Trigg 2 and BJ 2 and Hoist, I mean, those are going to be on greatest MMA fights ever reels forever, you know?
I want to ask you this question because oftentimes his the things that Matt Hughes does, excuse me, can often be, you know, sort of misinterpreted by the fans. Following the Sarah win to George St. Pierre at UFC 69, Hughes was sitting in the front row. He was laughing. He seemed to be having a great time about it. And some people thought that was kind of a shot at GSP, saying that, you know, he was happy that you know, following his defeat of Hughes, now he lost the belt in his first title defense. Or some were saying that he was happy to, you know, now he's going to get the shot at Sarah and shut him up for once. Did you have a take on that? What exactly was it? Because, you know, from where we were sitting, it seemed as a little disrespectful towards GSP to be sitting there laughing and high-fiving after the win. But, you know, maybe it was because of the whole Sarah situation.
We talk about this in the book, but it's clearly whole Sarah situation. Anyone with a straight face who looks at the record can agree that Matt Sarah beating GSP is ridiculous. And he was just laughing at the ridiculous situation. GSP is so head and shoulders above Matt Sarah that the fact that Matt Sarah got in that lucky punch and took him out is almost absurd, comically so. So Dana White's jaw was dropping, Matt's jaw was dropping, Sean Sharp's jaw was dropping. I'm sure every that house dropped when Matt Sarah actually took out GSP. And not even taking it out with submission, with a knockout, which I believe is the first knockout of his career. It was just absurd. And, you know, the fact is now that he will have a chance to fight Matt Sarah, otherwise Matt Sarah would never in a million years get another title shot.
In the last time we saw, you know, Hughes, he was supposed to be fighting Matt Sarah. He ended up fighting GSP just a couple of weeks ago. Losing the interim title fight to St. Pierre in the trilogy of their rivalry. You got to ask the question. You know, the book comes out, a lot going on outside the cage for him. Did you ever get the sense that maybe all of this was a distraction to Matt Hughes as he prepared for that fight with GSP?
I have never met anyone with more tunnel vision than Matt. The book coming out didn't affect him at all. I mean, these people and the publishers took care of, you know, things like that. So that wasn't an issue, but I mean, he was focused and he was ready for that fight. So there's no way he's the kind of guy who's going to let himself get distracted. He's so competitive; it's kind of scary.
Were you at UFC 79 or did you watch it elsewhere?
Yes, I was there.
Did you happen to talk to him after the bout? The first fight, it was sort of surprising the way, you know, he wasn't able to take down George St. Pierre, but I thought this fight was just, it didn't seem as for one second that Hughes had a shot. I mean, George St. Pierre's wrestling abilities have obviously improved over the years, but this seemed like it was a total mismatch. Were you shocked at how easily St. Pierre was able to defeat Hughes? And almost the irony of the way the fight ended was so similar to their first bout, except now GSP was able to really finish the deal and, you know, pull off the armbar.
Was I shocked? Yes, because, look, when it comes to MMA, Matt Hughes knows a lot more than I do. So if he tells me with a straight face I'm going to win, I believe him. You know what I mean? The second fight didn't go his way, and from my understanding, rubber matches, the third fight tends to go the way of the second fight. But he told me he was going to win, I believed him. So when that happened, especially given what a dominating force he's been in mixed martial arts, it was not easy to watch. Although, to be fair, it was harder to watch the Lytle fight because, for me, he's just this guy I've been hanging around with, and now he's in a cage, and watching it live that was the first time I've ever seen a live fight was kind of, you know, mind-blowing.
There has been some talk that he might retire after this bout, although that has kind of quieted down. Have you gotten a sense from him that he wants to fight just a couple more times, perhaps following the Sarah St. Pierre match that's tentatively scheduled for April in Montreal, that, you know, after that bout he might hang them up? Where's his head right now in his career? He talks about the farm, wanting to go back. He opened up the hit squad. What do you get the sense from him in terms of how many more fights he wants to, if any, fight in the octagon?
See, the thing about him and what makes him, I think, a good champion, which even the haters have to say, is that he never backs down from a fight. Whoever the UFC threw at him, he took. So I think he very much just looks at the next fight, and he'll play it by ear after that. I'm sure he wants to take on Sarah after GSP defeats him and shut him up for good, though.
All right, the book is called Made in America. Michael, before we let you go, we want to know, when you look back on the whole experience, is there anything you'd like to change the way the book came out? You know, a lot of times it goes through the editing mill and things happen to change for political reasons. Maybe Zufa wasn't happy with something. Was there anything that
Zufa never looked at the book, so there's no fear of that. The one thing, which is kind of a mistake, but which I'm glad is in there, is Matt remembered during BJ10-2, Pat Miletich being his corner, and he gave me the dialogue verbatim. I only checked the tape after the book came out, and it was actually Rich Franklin who was cornering him. So I thought that was really, really interesting that the fighter, at least in this case, registers the actual dialogue, but kind of does not register who the person is speaking, which kind of, I think, is an insight into the mind while you're in the cage.
So he actually knew word for word, because oftentimes it looks like they're not even listening to what their corner men are telling them.
Word for word.
Wow.
It was amazing. Yeah, I watched the tape, and I'm watching it. And in fact, the announcer even specifically says Pat Miletich couldn't be here, which really kind of drove me crazy. But then when Rich Franklin's talking, and there's the mic there, you could hear Rich talking, and he says verbatim what Matt had recounted to me.
So are you guys actually thinking about making a sequel to this book anytime soon, or is that just, you know, kind of talking?
I'm on the road with him for 2 weeks, just me and him sharing hotel rooms. So who knows what'll come out of that? We're as different as can be. So maybe we're going to come out of this the best of friends. Maybe one of us is coming home in a coffin. I can't answer that question, but I think it'll be an interesting story in of itself. It's like Rush Hour, but in real life.
Are you actually sharing a room with him, or you guys can't get separate rooms?
No, sharing rooms.
Wow, that's great. That's you're the envy of a lot of MMA fans, for better or worse.
And the something else of a lot of others.
Right, exactly. Michael, it was great talking with you. Awesome job on the book. Continued success, whether or not it's writing more MMA books on your websites, and I'm sure on many more books to come, and television. Hopefully we'll get to work with each other again. But the book is Made in America. You can get it on Amazon.com, any Barnes & Noble bookstore. It's on every bookstore. I was just in Florida, saw it in a small bookstore there.
Quick, if you go to matt-shoes.com, we're on a book tour right now, so we'll be at a city near you. We're all over America for the next 2 weeks, so you can come out and get the man to sign your book himself.
What are the first three stops? Just give us those first three.
New York, Mall of America, Chicago, St. Louis, L.A., Vegas, Birmingham, and Atlanta.
All right, all the big markets. Michael, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
My pleasure. Take care, buddy.